Welcome to this month's special guest interview.
This month, I'm very pleased to have Dr. Johnny Bowden as my special expert guest. Johnny Bowden, PhD, CNS, is a nationally known expert on weight loss, nutrition, and health. He is a board-certified nutritionist with a master's degree in psychology and the author of 8 best-selling books, including The 150 Healthiest Foods on Earth, Living Low Carb, The Most Effective Natural Cures on Earth, and The Most Effective Ways to Live Longer. A frequent guest on television and radio, he has appeared on Fox News, CNN, MSNBC, ABC, NBC, and CBS as an expert on nutrition, weight loss, and longevity. Dr. Bowden is a past member of the editorial advisory board for Men's Health Magazine, is the nutrition editor for Pilates Style, and is a regular contributor to AOL, Vanity Fair Online, Clean Eating Magazine, Better Nutrition, and Total Health Online. Dr. Bowden has written or contributed to articles for dozens of national publications, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, the Daily Beast, Vanity Fair Online, Time, Oxygen, Marie Claire, Diabetes Focus, GQ, US Weekly, Cosmopolitan, Self Fitness, Family Circle, Allure, Men's Health, Prevention, Natural Health, and many others. The list goes on. Good morning, Johnny. Welcome to this month's edition of Sports Nutrition Update.
Good morning, Corey. Great to talk to you. Long time.
Absolutely. Long time. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you. I respect
your work, what you've been doing. We've met and we've participated in the same, I guess, field of endeavor for many, many years. And now it's time to get you online and get into your mind, and maybe you can share some of that massive amount of knowledge you've got. But, you know, everyone likes to hear about the personal background of our guests. So maybe you can tell us where you're from, where you grew up, and how you developed such a strong interest in nutrition science and natural health.
I was a professional musician, Corey, and I worked as a musician, as a pianist, as a conductor. I toured with a lot of shows, and I was typical musician shape, which was to say fat, out of shape, smoked cigarettes, woke up at noon, you know, the whole bit. And I just spent a lot of time on the road with these actors, and two things to know about that. One is they all stay in shape, and two is it's very boring on the road. So I was sitting around one day at the Goodspeed Opera House, and I said to one of the guys who was really in good shape, used to go to the gym all the time, could you teach me how to do these weights? What is with this stuff? I'd like to, you know, lose a few pounds. Well, it was just the beginning of a journey. I mean, within a very short time, I was kind of hooked. I did not transform my body and my health overnight. I continued to smoke while I went to the gym, but I did get into weights. I did start reading Muscle and, well, we call it Muscle and Fiction magazine, but, you know, basically all of the popular magazines. I became a kind of a fanatic. Eventually, I stopped smoking, changed my diet, really saw the changes in my own health and energy and vitality, and I got bitten by this, you know, and being a kind of, you know, overachieving, academically oriented, middle-class Jew from New York City, the first thing I thought of is, I got to get a degree in this, you know, because I have to find some way of, you know, getting authoritative information, because, you know, as you know, someone starting out in this field, all you got is, you know, Flex magazine and Muscle and Fiction, and it's, everything's contradictory. Everybody has a different point of view. You know, it's very hard to sort out the truth from, you know, advertising hype and promotional hype. So I wanted some kind of a foundation, some kind of a background in this. It was, I still looked at it as a hobby. I decided to get certified as a personal trainer. I picked up one certification, then I decided, well, that's not enough. And I started becoming kind of a fitness certification groupie, collected 6 of them ultimately, you know, American College of Sports Medicine, National Academy of Sports Medicine, Aerobics and Fitness Association of America, you know, you name it, I had them all. And right around this time, Equinox Fitness Clubs, which I don't know if you have in Canada yet, but it is one of the biggest and most successful chains in the country here, they were opening their very, very first gym ever in Manhattan, first time ever. And I went in, and, you know, all ballsy, and I applied as a job for a trainer, and I got it. And I started taking less and less of these music jobs on the road, and it was a kind of a career transition for me, and I just fell in love with it, and I started there at Equinox as a floor trainer, and I kind of rose up in the ranks pretty quickly. I had a little bit more education than a lot of the people who were on the floor, and I was a little older because it was a career change, so I had a certain, I guess, a maturity, and clients would talk to me and discuss their issues, and I started to see pretty quickly that this is not just about, you know, do more aerobics and eat a low-fat diet, and I started to talk to them about things like hormones and stress, and began to see what a complicated endeavor this was. And at this point, I guess I was full-time doing this. I was pretty qualified as a trainer. I kind of knew my exercise. But the only nutrition education that trainers get, as you probably know, or certainly the only education we got at that time, was the same old claptrap from the American Dietetic Association that they've been fostering on the American public for the last, I don't know how many years since they've been invented, apologizing for every establishment position, taking a reactionary position on everything from supplements to lower carb diets, you know, and we would just get fed this stuff, and I just repeated, and I saw that it wasn't really working for clients that well, and then fortuitously, Barry Sears, the brilliant biochemist who wrote the very famous books, you know, in the Zone series, came to town. He had just published The Zone. He was speaking at Equinox, and he had a pretty revolutionary idea at the time. Now, of course, now it's all very well accepted, and the 40-30-30 plan has been validated in a million different studies. But at the time, what you have to remember, Corey, is that at the time, this guy's coming around saying, we're eating a little bit too many carbs. Remember, he was not fanatic. He was pretty balanced. But he said, we're eating a little too many carbs. We're not eating enough fat. We need to change this proportion to get our blood sugar right. He's talking about blood sugar and insulin and hormones. Nobody was talking about that. The only person who had even talked about that, who had broken through to the public at that time, was Atkins, and pretty much, for various social reasons, you know, too involved to get into, everybody hated Atkins. Nobody took him seriously. Even though he was right about so many things, he was dismissed. But here comes Barry Sears saying similar things, not exactly the same things, but similar things about fat not being bad and about, you know, controlling insulin and talking about hormones. Nobody was talking about this. I sat down with Barry Sears for 2 hours. And he went through this methodically with me. And I remember saying to him, and he quotes this all the time. He still remembers it 15 years, 20 years later. I said to him, Barry, if you're right about this, everybody else is wrong. And he looked at me and said, exactly. And that was the beginning of my quest to really learn about nutrition, not just to get the crap that we were taught by as personal trainers, the same old low-fat diet, you know, do some more aerobics. And I went back to school. The first thing I did was get my CN, which is no longer, it's a private licensed certified nutritionist. It was a program given by the National Institute of Nutrition Education, which is now defunct. After that, I spent a year studying for the CNS exam, the most difficult certification, I think, on the planet, the certified nutrition specialist. And then I went back and got a PhD in holistic nutrition. So I have been kind of doing nutrition ever since. I phased out the personal training part of my repertoire around, you know, 10 years ago. And I've just been, you know, writing books, and I'm up to, I think the 10th is about to be published, books and articles, and running the website, johnnyboden.com, and lecturing around the country, and that's where I met you at one of the Clayton conferences, and that's pretty much what I've been doing, and that's kind of how I got there.
Wowzer. Wowzer. Hey, you remind me of a guy named Casey Kasem. Have you ever heard of him?
Oh, my God. You're very funny.
You sound like him, man. I mean, we get him once in a while up here in the Great White North. The energy and enthusiasm you've got is brilliant, man. And that's what health is all about, isn't it?
It is. It is.
Now, let's get into some teachers and mentors. Who are some of the great men out there, the pioneers, that really had a major impact on your thinking and the direction that you took towards health?
The number one mentor, the man with whom, which with, without whom I don't believe I'd be doing what I'm doing today, was the great Robert Crahan, who so sadly died last year of colon cancer at a ridiculously young age of 49. And he was pretty much my mentor. He is the one who got me enthusiastic and excited about this. He is someone who probably has taught more doctors, chiropractors, health professionals, nutritionists, you name it, nurse practitioners. I mean, he's very famous for his seminars and his brilliance and his Boulder Fest conferences on nutritional medicine. I'd say he was pretty much my major influence. I'm very fond of the work of Mark Hyman. I love the work of Leo Galland, you know, Daniel Amen in the field of brain and brain health. There's just an awful lot of people around. Both doctors, Mary Dan and Mike Eads, good friends of mine, the authors of Protein Power, tremendous influences. There's a brain surgeon named Larry McCleary who wrote the Brain Trust Program and a couple of other books, who's, you know, very much been a mentor and someone I can you know, bounce ideas off. Jacob Teitelbaum, the go-to guy for fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue. Mark Houston, MD, the go-to guy for hypertension and heart disease. Steve Sinatra, the late Shari Lieberman, the nutritionist who wrote The Gluten Connection, among other things. All of these people have been just wonderful support systems and people to bounce ideas off. Elson Haas, as you know, from Clayton. I feel like someone giving an Oscar speech. I'm probably leaving out 10 people, but that's the basic, I guess. Those are the basic influences.
Now, something came up now with Robert. He was 49. Now, what about the critics who look at him and say, okay, here's a guy that's into health and preaching health and living health, and dies at 49 of cancer. So what is your response to that?
I had the same issue with Shari Lieberman when she died of breast cancer at 51. These are superbly healthy people who do absolutely all the right things. And, you know, as the expression goes, you know what happens. Now, here's my answer to that. There are actions one can take in life that significantly, demonstrably reduce the risk of particular things happening. For example, wearing your seatbelt demonstrably reduces the risk of getting killed in an auto accident. Not driving drunk demonstrably reduces the risk. But it doesn't eliminate it. It doesn't mean that some crazy drunk teenager who's texting while he's driving isn't going to jump the divide and hit you, even if you've got your seatbelt on, even if you're driving a great car, even if you're driving completely sober. It can happen. Now, these guys did absolutely everything right. But you can't reduce the risk to zero. You can lower the risk for things happening. I mean, look, there are people who smoke cigarettes and they don't get lung cancer. There are people like that. Not everybody who smokes gets lung cancer, but you sure decrease the risk of getting it if you don't smoke. So I don't read into that any kind of conclusion that, like, look, you can do everything right and stuff can still happen. Of course you can do everything right and stuff still happens. But neither of those two people who died at such an early age doing everything right, they would be mortified at the idea that people would take from their death the lesson that none of this matters, because it does matter tremendously. It just doesn't reduce the risk to zero. There are some things out of our control. Things happen. You know, you get exposed to some god-awful, you know, carcinogen that your body can't detox. Who knows? Your genetic makeup. There could be a million different reasons. But I don't think that invalidates in any way the smartness of doing the things that they taught and that they did themselves.
Yeah, that's a great response, because people are always looking for a reason not to do what we are advocating.
Let me give you the reverse of that. A guy runs through a dynamite factory with a lighted match and he comes out the other side. That doesn't mean he's not an idiot. Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, just like you can do some really cockamamie stupid things and survive them, it doesn't mean those are good things to do. And just because you can do all the right things and a bad thing still happens, you don't tell people don't wear your seatbelts because one guy got killed. You look at the 99,000 people who didn't get killed who survived accidents because they did wear their seatbelts.
True.
And I think that that's really the take-home lesson here. Not that these things are not worth doing, but that they do not completely wipe out the risk of everything. They just don't. Robert had a fantastic famous saying. He said, the danger with nutrition is thinking that it does too little and thinking that it does too much.
Yeah, that's powerful. That's really powerful. So we're born terminal. Isn't that part of the issue? I mean, you can't criticize a guy for dying or anybody for ultimately running into the wall, because we are all headed in that direction. But it's quality of life, isn't it?
It's how we get there. You know, my most recent book, The Most Effective Ways to Live Longer, there's quite a lot of research on longevity, as you know. A lot of stuff on the blue zones, those four, or now there are five areas of the globe where people routinely live to 100 in magnificent health. The Nunn study, you know, the Baltimore longitudinal study. A lot of these studies look at long-lived people and, you know, kind of trying to get some lessons. Like, what do these guys do? And when I wrote the Most Effective Ways to Live Longer, I looked at all the research on that, and I, you know, read the research and tried to find some good take-home points that people could wrap their minds around in terms of actual things they could do in their lives that would make a difference. And, it, you know, it's pretty clear that staying alive, remaining alive, is not really the goal here. I mean, we can keep people alive now better than we ever could before. You know, you want to be hooked up to tubes and kept on life support and, be in assisted living and have, you know, an oxygen tube through your nose, you can probably, you know, stay around a really long time. But nobody's really, when we talk about living longer, you and I are not talking about that. You and I are talking about having vitality and libido and energy and vitality and optimism and involvement and engagement well into our decades in the double digits. You know, we're talking about that kind of life. And I think that that's what, you know, lifestyle changes, changes in nutrition and health and well-being and sun exposure and the proper amount of sleep and all of that, and relationships, that's what those things have to offer us. It's not just extended number of breaths that we take on this planet. It's the quality of our life. And that's really, you know, that's what my book's about. And I know that that's what your work is about. And that's really what we're here for, is to talk about how to improve the quality of those years, not just the number of them.
And what about these documentaries on the centurions, you know, like everybody presented in the documentaries over the age of 100, and they look for commonalities. And then again, the critics will say, well, I don't see these people eating organic, fresh, whole food. I don't see them talking about going to the gym every day. And again, they're looking for a reason not to do what we're promoting. So what's your response to these people?
It's a great question. And I've said that in every lecture I've given on this subject, is that, you know, the people in these blue zones, they don't know what a gym is. There are no gyms there. They don't know what a supplement is. They don't have health food stores. I mean, most of these blue zones, with maybe one exception, like Loma Linda, which is in the middle, you know, of Southern California, you know, they're small societies. And I remember in the book, The Blue Zones, Dan Buettner, the writer, showed one of the residents of, I think it was the peninsula that's off Costa Rica, that's one of the blue zones, they showed her a McDonald's and she didn't know what it was. She said, what do you do with this? She didn't even know it was food. So, yes, you're absolutely right. They don't know from organic or not. But if you look at what they do in their lives, they do all the things that these things like gyms offer our technological society that don't do those things. For example, you know, Sardinia, they're hiking with sheep up a mountain every day. You know, yeah, they don't go to the gym, but try doing that hike with that guy. So, you know, the gym is just our modern adaptation, you know, on how to get this stuff into our life, because it's so sorely lacking in our life. There's nothing magical about the gym. There's something magical about exercise. And in the old days when they trained for the Olympics, they did it by lifting calves. You know, they didn't have weights. So, you know, the point is your muscles don't care what you use to stress them and work them and keep them alive. You can use, you know, water bottles. You can use a calf, you know, a piglet. You can, you know, climb a mountain with sheep. There's a million things you can do. They don't eat organic food, but I'm willing to bet Monsanto isn't in there spraying their crops. They grow them in their gardens. They don't know from organic. It is organic. The point is, you know, they live a life with a lot less of the poisons and the distractions and the elements in our life that age us and diminish the quality of our lives. Those things are not necessarily there in these societies. And I think that's an important thing to remember. You know, you can't just look at gym membership as a measure of health. You have to look at what do people actually do with their bodies and with their lives. These people in the blue zones have very powerful relationships. They're very powerful social networks. They're never isolated. They do community work of some kind. They may not call it charity. It may be a potluck dinner on Sundays, but there's face-to-face contact. There's involvement. There's engagement. There's some sun exposure. They sleep well. They have long conversations. There's a lot of things that they do. And, you know, I don't know that the fact that they don't go to Whole Foods to buy in the organic department really makes much of a difference given what they are doing.
You know, I've been to the five blue zones, Johnny, and,
yes,
and
really?
When I was younger, and the latest one, Loma Linda, more recently, but I had no idea they were blue zones. So I think that it's just a region geographically that receives this blue light from outer space. And I was exposed.
That's certainly one way to look at it. And, you know, there may be a genetic factor as well. We don't, you know, I'm fond of saying genes loads the gun, but environment pulls the trigger. But it doesn't hurt to have good genes as well. You can wipe out the effect of good genes by doing bad stuff, and you can probably negate most of the effects of bad genes by doing good stuff. But, you know, genes make a difference, too, and there may be a factor in there as well.
No doubt. Now, you've written some great books, and the content is excellent. Obviously,
Thank
you've
you.
Done your homework, your research, and I'm a writer, too, and I commend you on the work that you've done.
Thank you, Corey.
Now, what is the name of your first book? And this interests me because, you know, when you put together your first book as someone who's never written before, it takes a whole lot and something's driving it. So What was the name of your first book, and why did
you write
it?
Well, I'm embarrassed to tell you, the first book is like, you know, I don't know, you ever see sometimes with these movie stars, they'll show you like little cameos they had in some dumb horror movie the first time that they were ever, and everybody laughs because my first book is like that horror movie. Nobody bought it. It came out right around 9/11. It sold no copies, you know, under 10,000 copies. And it was called Johnny Bowden's Shape Up, the 8-Week Program to Transform Your Body, Your Health, and Your Life. And it's out of print now, and that was my first. But my first one that broke through, my first one that made any kind of a splash was Living Low Carb, Controlled Carbohydrate Eating for Long-Term Weight Loss. It was just released in its new edition in 2010, completely revised and expanded, and it's been out for about 6 years, and it continually does well. And my other one that I guess really put me on the map was the 150 Healthiest Foods on Earth. So those two are really the ones that I guess I got the most play and attention from.
Now, the low-carb book, now tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that came out in 2004 when low-carb was just experiencing its first renaissance. You know, up until then, it had just been these few Atkins diehards and the Atkins diet, which was, I don't want to say discredited, but it certainly wasn't taken seriously by anyone in traditional or conventional medicine, which, by the way, is not such a badge of dishonor because, you know, they're the last ones to get on board with anything that works. But it was very easy to dismiss. Atkins wasn't a particularly likable guy. He was very arrogant. You know, his theories were so far off the, you know, out of the mainstream. He was easy to dismiss. But then in 2004, a few studies came out saying, hey, wait a minute, let's take another look at this. Some of these things we've been thinking are true of this are just not so. And a bunch of studies came out, I don't remember all of them, they're all in my files, I've quoted them a million times, but there were a bunch of them basically, you know, questioning some of the critiques on low carb and actually showing that low carb worked as well or better in head-to-head comparisons. And there was, you know, I don't know what it was like in Canada, but in America, these low-carb supermarkets started coming out. The South Beach Diet came up. There was about 15 different low-carb books in the same year. So my book, Living Low Carb, was really meant to be a user-friendly. It wasn't in deep scientific language. It was meant to be understood. But it was heavily notated, heavily footnoted, heavily referenced, and it was meant to be a cohesive argument about why low-carb diets work, who they work for, what they do, what their effect on heart disease is, on polycystic ovary syndrome, on insulin resistance, on metabolic syndrome, on diabetes, and, you know, what the connection was. And then I took, at the time it was about 19, now it's up to 38, different diets and evaluated them. I wrote about, you know, these different diet books, the Fat Flush Plan, the South Beach Diet, the Atkins Plan, the Protein Powder, the GO Diet, whatever they were, and I kind of reviewed them, said what was good about them, what was not so good about them, gave them my Johnny 5-star or 3-star or 2-star or 1-star rating. And there was a chapter on there about the myths of fat and cholesterol and the myths of low-carb dieting, like kidney damage and bone loss and all of that stuff. And I took these things on one at a time and discussed them in detail. And that's basically what that book is.
Oh, that's excellent, man. That's some good stuff. Now, here's the $60 million question. Are dietary carbohydrates essential to human beings?
No. The answer is no. It's a very clear answer. They're not essential. That does not mean that we shouldn't eat them. What it does mean, and the thing that I tell audiences all the time, I think it's dramatic and it's important that people know, and when I say they're not essential, I don't want anyone to leave hearing this interview saying he says you should eat no carbohydrates. I am not saying that. What I'm saying is this. If I'm standing in front of an audience and I say to you guys, we're all going to go on Survivor. This group here on the left, you're going on the island for a year with nothing to eat but protein and fat. This group here on the right, you're going on the island for a year with nothing to eat but carbohydrates. The group on the left's going to be fine in a year. The group on the right's going to be dead. So what I point out to people is not that you shouldn't be eating carbohydrates, but isn't it interesting that every major health organization recommends a diet that's 60% the one thing you don't even need to live? That's kind of odd to me.
Well, it's beyond odd. It defies all logic and reason. I use the Plains American Indian as an example of sustainability, and you know how important that word is.
Mm-hmm.
So if these people followed the herd and consumed very little in the way of carbs, and primarily for maybe 8-9 months, obviously in cold, brutal winters, they followed the bison. Remember those beautiful creatures that used to roam your country?
Of course.
So, Lauren Cordain says the same thing, and he's a paleontologist, and you probably know him.
Sure, he's wonderful. And he points out a very interesting thing. I'm sure you know this paper, but many people who might not have heard of it. It's called Cereal Grains, Humanity's Double-Edged Sword. And it's a 100-page paper, heavily, as you know, Cordain is a professor, I think University of Colorado. He's very, very academic. He references everything. It's all research. And what he points out in that paper is that we wouldn't have civilization without grains. You couldn't feed the planet without grains. You couldn't have people living in cities without grains. There's just not enough wild animals and, you know, to sustain 6.2 and going up to 7 billion people on the planet. So the double-edged sword is, on the one hand, grains give us the ability to have civilization. On the other hand, they're not good for us. They're just not that good for us. And he goes through, you know, study after study showing, you know, when grains were introduced, when agriculture height dropped, you know, different measures of bone health, and, you know, they look at the bones of people and it can tell what stages different diseases were in. Generally, you know, they have not been a boon for health. Maybe they would be a good addition to the diet in a smaller amount, but we consume about, you know, an enormous amount of wheat, an enormous amount of these things, which are relatively new. The human genus has been on the planet for 2.4 million years. Agriculture was invented 10,000 years ago. We're talking about, on a 24-hour time clock, this stuff's like 2 minutes old. So a lot of people haven't had time to adapt to that. And I think that's one of the reasons you see so much gluten intolerance. And we're just not adapted to this amount of starch and grains in our diet. And I don't think that they're necessarily a bad thing. And I certainly don't think carbohydrates are a bad thing. But what I think is interesting, and this is really worth repeating, is that there have been societies that have thrived on 80% carbohydrate diets, like the Bantu of South Africa. And there have been societies that have thrived on zero carbohydrates, like the Inuit in Greenland, where a vegetable doesn't grow. So it's all walrus meat and seal meat and blubber and, you know, and they do fine. Here's what we have never seen in history and never will: a society that has thrived on a high sugar diet. So even in the Bantu, where they're eating, what do you think they're eating? They're eating these hard little fruits that fall on the ground and these little berries and these, yeah, sure, they're carbohydrates, but they're not Twinkies. Do you see what I mean? So I think that it's really not so much the proportion of carbs, fat, and protein, but the quality of the food that we eat. And most, I'm sorry to say, most of the carbohydrates in our diet are crap. That doesn't mean that cauliflower and broccoli and apples and berries, I mean, these things are loaded with phytonutrients, but that's not what we're eating. That's not what's making us fat. It's not what's making us sick and tired and depressed. It's these high-starch, high-sugar diets, or these foods that turn into sugar in about 1 second, that the American Dietetic Association thinks is so good for us, like grains and pasta and rice, which basically, once it hits your stomach goes, here comes the sugar, doesn't know the difference. I think it's that front-loading our diet with those kinds of starches that really gets us into trouble. It's not carbohydrates as a class of food. And I certainly don't mean to demonize them that way. I mean, eat carbohydrates. But the point is, you know, the average American consumes about 300 grams or more of carbohydrates a day. You don't need anything like that. You can do perfectly well. You can get all the vegetables you could fit into a 747 jet with, you know, 100 grams of carbs a day. So, you know, once you cut back those heavy, nutrient-depleted, calorie-intensive foods, you're really eating a very healthy diet, and there's plenty of room in there for healthy carbohydrates.
Yeah, excellent. And we're right on the same page with that, man. That was great. So,
thank you.
Now, tell us about your personal diet. What does Johnny Bowden eat day by day?
Yeah, it's another one of those do what I say, not what I do. Well, you know, what do I eat on a daily basis? I guess, well, let's start with my late night eating. I, like everybody else in the world, you know, have my struggles with late night eating. But what I'm particularly proud of is that I have not conquered the late night eating thing, but I have really raised the bar on what it is. So instead of a pint of Häagen-Dazs, which a portion size is, you know, until the spoon hits the bottom of the carton, that's the portion size. Instead of that, every single night, without fail, I have, you know, a big bowl of frozen blueberries covered with Greek or sheep yogurt, almonds, and coconut flakes. And that's my late night snack, and it's pretty darn healthy. During the day, I'll usually have, I mean, here are some of the things, not necessarily in the order that I eat them in, but I have a lot of chicken. I only eat grass-fed meat, and I eat it about once or twice a week. Grass-fed burgers that I get from, you know, U.S. Wellness Meats. I have links to all these places on my website, so you can get all this stuff. And they're not companies I own. They're just companies I think are great. I eat a lot of fish, a lot of salmon. I get it from Vital Choice, also a link on my website. They ship it in from Alaska. It's wild salmon, very different than farmed salmon. Just like grass-fed meat is very different than regular meat. And then, you know, I have some vegetables. I'll have a Barlean's green drink once a day usually, and I find that really stabilizes blood sugar and keeps you full, takes the edge off your appetite, gives you a lot of phytonutrients for very little calories. I try to eat an apple or some berries, well, I mentioned the berries, every day, and that's pretty much, you know, eggs, whole eggs. When I'm not too lazy to go to get it, raw milk, which is, I think, probably one of the greatest health foods in the world.
Yeah, I derive my late-night eating standards from Cheech and Chong.
Dude, I'm with you.
I use
That's
the.
I'm so proud that I've graduated to blueberries, coconut flakes, and almonds, and yogurt instead of.
Yeah, we use garbage cans for popcorn. And, you know, that's amazing. And I'm glad that you went there first, because that is a huge problem, that late night eating. And
yes.
And for a lot of people, you know, I guess what you're trying to stress here is the quality over the quantity. If you can impress upon your mind the fact that the lower quality, refined, damaged, fractionated food loaded with who knows what is going to really cause a lot of damage compared to, say, eating 10 oranges or the more healthier alternatives. That's the first start, I guess.
Yeah, very good.
So what we recommend is protein shakes. We always have a protein shake at nighttime. We have several throughout the day.
Good.
And I find
that
really helps reduce the cravings for sweets and sugars with a lot of the clients.
Absolutely.
And also, as you know, eating more frequently throughout the day and knowing that there's more to come. So you get away from this, today is the last day of my life, so I might as well stuff as much in as I can.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, Corey.
My goodness, we're getting close to the end here, and I hardly got to any of the questions. But you filled in a lot of the thoughts I wanted to get to just by the depth of your responses and the realism.
Thank you.
And you're sincere and you're real, and that's so hard to find in this world.
Thank you, Corey. It's so sweet of you to say. It means a lot coming from you. I'm a great admirer, and I appreciate that very much. If I can give a shameless plug to my website, it's johnnyboden.com, and there's no H in Johnny, J-O-N-N-Y-B-O-W-D. And there's a lot of good free stuff on there. There's a webinar on 7 supplements that, you know, I think are essential for everybody, and there's a couple things on, you know, the 9 essential steps to weight loss, all free, audio courses, webinars. So go to my website, sign up for some of that stuff, get my newsletter, and follow me on Twitter.
Fantastic. So it's Johnny Boden. Bodendon.com, JohnnyBodenDen. For everyone out there, get to the site. Yes, and this link will be on our site. Just go to SNU, click that, and you'll find Johnny's bio and his links to his site, and check it out.
Thank you. Get some
of those books, everybody. Add those to your library. You've got some e-books, don't you, too?
A couple of e-books. There's 50 Fantastic Ways to Turbocharge to Make Your Diet Work. There's a free one that's on the website, 29 Tips for a Healthy Life, and there's some good new projects coming up down the road this year that I hope I'll get to tell you about.
Oh, absolutely fantastic. And because you are the man, I want you to leave us, please, with something inspirational that we can think about for the rest of the day.
God, I thought you were going to tell me to sing a song. Well, you're putting me a little on the spot, but I like that. If I had to leave people with one piece of advice, it's like, don't try to get all the answers. There are not all the answers. You do the best you can a day at a time. You get the best information you can. You try it on. You see if it works. You have to respect that everybody is biochemically and hormonally and metabolically unique. What works for your neighbor doesn't necessarily work for you. You have to respect that individuality. You have to find your own path. And don't sweat it if you don't have all the answers right now. None of us do. The smartest of us know how little that we really know.
Dr. Johnny Boden has been my special expert guest today on SNU. Dr. Boden is an expert on nutrition, fitness, and health. He's been a guest on television and radio. Get to his website. Check out his books. Johnny, we thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
We hope you've enjoyed the topics discussed and our special guest interview on this edition of Sports Nutrition Update. SNU is produced monthly and is distributed internationally by the Corey Hawley Institute. To learn how you can subscribe to this unique and motivational audio program, please visit CoreyHawley.com or call us toll-free in the U.S. and Canada at 1-866-433-1595. That's 1-866-433-1595. This is Scott Barrett, wishing you the very best of health and fitness for life.
represent his lifestyle. New way of life. Listen. It's SNU, sing along, it's true. Yo, coming through straight. Malik with sports nutrition update. Prolong your life. Live long, stay strong, for it won't be long till your time is gone. So I sing this song to pass on wisdom. Hit us up at CoreyHolly.com. Love your life, live right, things will be alright. Knowledge is key, just follow our lead. You'll see ya changing heart and health, which leads to wealth and higher self-esteem. Follow your dreams and see. Follow your dreams and see.